Hi, and welcome to the French Tech Asia Pacific podcast, a show where we talk to French founders, local influencers, and policymakers here in the APAC region. I'm your host, Nikolai, and this week's guest is Frédéric Noël, a longtime game developer and co-founder of Thirdkind, a mobile game publishing company based in Tokyo, Japan. Frederick's lived in Japan for almost a decade and has shared with us many interesting insights on both the habits of Japanese consumers when it comes to video games, as well as on entrepreneurship in Japan in general. Since we feel that both of these topics are worthy of attention, we've decided to do something a little bit different this week. We'll be publishing our conversation with Frederick in two parts. This first part will be a deep dive into Japanese mobile gaming market, and we'll cover things such as the differences in gaming preferences between Western and Japanese consumers, as well as the importance of content and microtransactions on the Japanese market. The second part, which we'll release early next week, will cover how the Japanese are slowly but surely changing their outlook on the merits of entrepreneurship, and we'll cover some of the common pitfalls when first entering the market and how to avoid them. So, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Frédéric Noël, and I hope you enjoy this first part of our conversation on the mobile game industry in Japan.
So, I'm Frédéric Noël. So, I'm working in the game industry for a while now, for probably 18 years old now. So, the way I study is like I study as a game engineer. I've been actually programming games since I'm 12. Games on like what we call at that time like an Amstrad. It's a computer we could find in France. I just wanted to work in the video games industry, and I just had I was doing a master degree, and I had the opportunity to work for a game company in France, and that's how I started. So I worked on the Nintendo Game Boy Advance game at that time, and then I just wanted to change atmosphere and decided to come to Japan. And that's actually where I started the entrepreneurship's adventure here. So still in the game industry. So as of right now, my company, which is called Thirdkind, it's a game company, much more like a game publisher. So we're actually like publishing smartphone games from broad US, Korea, Asia, France, anywhere in the world. We take those content and we're publishing them in Japan. So all those games are smartphone games. Not console games. So we're focusing only on smartphone games. So we're publishing those content, localizing, commercializing by doing like marketing promotions, negotiating placements to the App Store and the Google Play Store as well. And we also working with a local partner. By working with them, we're using the brand and adding additional content for those smartphone games for the Japanese market, so that it gives additional value for Japanese users.
Very rich background in really hands-on game development, as you mentioned. So both in Europe and in Japan. Japan is a country that holds somewhat of a special status for us gamers who grew up on the early Nintendo consoles, right?
Right.
Could you elaborate a bit on the differences between the industries in the two continents, both from a personal and a professional perspective?
I would start as a user. It's the same. I mean, I grew up with like all those like Mega Man, Street Fighter, Mario, all those like Japanese game actually, and that's how I grew up and loving all those simple but like cute and well balanced, well with the great game mechanic games, and as well as RPG. And actually, I'm not gonna say that's the main difference, but and I'm switching from the user experience to the little bit like professional. But I guess like in Japan, we see a lot of RPGs and people like RPGs. the Final Fantasy VII. That's really where it started in Europe, to like people start to play more those kind of game because the quality was great for Final Fantasy VII. But I would say, as a user point of view, the main difference is like the style of the game. For example, like in Japan, we're never gonna play like at that time it was like Quake or Doom, like a first-person shooter.
Yeah.
We don't. Japanese don't play those games.
Oh, really?
So you may find like no. You may find. I mean, I'm not gonna say 100%. Obviously, you may find like few people play those games. Obviously, but that's not the main game people are playing here. Definitely not. So if you talk here about Doom, I'm pretty sure like 90% people I'm talking to, they don't know Doom. Same for Quake. They may play like a little bit more like Fortnite recently. Maybe because it's on the phone and like, I don't know. I mean, like games are more like, it's easier to see like foreign game on smartphone now than on console. On console, to see the foreign game, then you need to find a specific publisher that's going to publish your foreign game in the Japanese market, which was more complicated for console because of many requirements. And it's easier on smartphone actually. So I guess, but that's not the kind of game like people would play here. Most of the game would be the main, I guess, kind of the genre people play here. It's like RPG.
So there's a big genre difference, as you say. So mostly RPG, less first person shooter. Are there differences in consumer behavior within those games? What's the Japanese stance on microtransactions and downloadable content and all that kind of stuff?
Right. So the things that it's really important to know is like just even before the smartphone, before like the era before smartphone, before iPhone, people were had phone like which called like feature phones. So we call that in Japan like grake. So it's the feature phones. You know, it's the clamshell kind of phone.
Yeah.
And people had those phones, like. Most of the content were like HTML, and people were actually browsing the internet at that time. It was like early 2000, I would say. And in France, for example, we didn't have any internet. We had like maybe like some iMode and stuff like that, or the WAP. So people had those phones and we're already playing like HTML kind of game. It was really simple games. But already in early 2000, Japanese game and content were using the microtransactions as a business model, as a way of payments. Which in Europe and even in the US, we started to see that like way later after the smartphone arrived. And it was like probably early beginning 2011, 2012, maybe, I guess. So that's one of the big difference. One of the main reasons is because it's kind of like unthinkable for the Japanese content, like to, or Japanese company to, okay, we have a game, then it's free for the first two levels. And then if you manage to clear those two first level, then you need to pay additional price to access the remaining contents. That's something that's not acceptable. You're probably not gonna see that in Japanese game. It's kind of like the way of thinking is much more like you need to understand that the customer is king in Japan. It's not like in France we say the customer is king, and like. If the customer requires something, then the company or the people making a product is going to try to adjust so that they're going to satisfy the customer. Well, it's not, while it's not totally true in France, well, in Japan, it's 100% true, actually. The customer is really king. Why I'm saying that is because it's, and going back to the game, the microtransaction story, it's much more like the idea is to provide free content. So user can play whatever they want. They're free. They can even finish the game if it's like if they take their time. I'm obviously talking about smartphone right now still.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, if you don't pay, then it will take you more time to complete the game, and you're not gonna have access to all the different and great equipment, for example. Right. So the incentive is like you can have like rare item. Like if I'm using the RPG as an example, you can have rare equipment, rare weapons, power up and stuff like that. Only if you pay additional money on everything. But if you don't want to do, that's okay because you can still finish the game. You can still move forward. It takes you just more time. So, and the thing is like the Japanese consumers, they really like into the having all the available equipment and everything. So they're going to spend money, obviously.
Oh, really?
Not everybody, but yeah they're going to spend money.
They're completists. Like, I mean, want to collect.
So it's obviously, it doesn't like concern like 100% of the Japanese customer, obviously, but it's like a few percent, it's a person, a kind of big percentage of them. And like, as an example, like in one of our game, our most successful game, like we could see all the transaction that user, like how they were spending all their money. And easily, like people were spending like more than, in dollar would be like more than $1,000 a month or something like that, really easily. And that's the trend we started to see more, actually, even in the US, little by little, when the US company started to use the same similar model. Going back to the initial question, like, yeah, Japanese customer like really gets used to like play content which is free and open. Then if we want to have access to additional feature power-up, then need to spend additional money. In Europe, it's not something that was... Now it works. So I believe that the model are similar. And as of 2019, in Japan and in Europe or US as well, it's similar models. But pre-iPhone, even when the iPhone just arrived, like in France, we were still seeing like model which like premium. We call that premium. So you pay to play. Or you pay to have, you pay like a specific price to unlock the remaining contents. So Japanese content is like, it's everything is, the content is there, but additional specific weapon, right. rare item that's not really required to complete the game, then you have to make additional purchase for that.
It's interesting to see that Japan was so early on those microtransactions, yep. And that they, that the other countries presumably inspired themselves and on that model. Do you think that today monetization in Japan is still easier than in Europe or in the US, or do you think that, that it's now more or less equal across the board?
So the monetization itself, and I mean, I guess like the business model, it's similar now. So like Europe and US got caught up. So now it's the same. I guess the main difference and what's going to make like probably like Japanese game or Japanese content more like consume, like where people's going to spend easily more money, is the customer support and everything which is like additional value for the users. Meaning that with the same business model, with the same micro transaction system, with the Japanese content, because like Japanese company is going to provide like weekly events, for example. Weekly event that's going to allow you, like if you join this event, you're going to have the possibility to have access to new, totally unique item, for example, this kind of stuff. Japanese companies are really great at that. They're really good at doing this kind of stuff. So to answer your question, the model now is the same in terms of like purchase and payment. So Japan is not like more advanced or less advanced. It's similar, I guess. But the way to make user pay, Japan is still on the edge, I guess. Because it's goes back to what I told you at the beginning. It's like Japanese customer is the king. So in order to keep the users keep playing the game, then you need to make him satisfied. So how do you make him satisfied? Then you add new content weekly to weekly or monthly, new content, new events, like opportunities. You give new opportunity to the Japanese user to spend money, actually. So, but you know what? I mean, that's actually what it is. Because the Japanese user, like, as long as you give him content, he's going to be happy to spend money and to invest his time into the game. But you need to provide content to him.
So to bring this back to your company, I understand that you raised capital rather quickly after starting up, after a strong initial success in this free-to-play space. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so in order to explain that, I have to explain how we started this business. And so I met a Japanese, I worked with someone, with a Japanese guy who used to work at Capcom, and we worked together in a company for, it's like a sister company of SoftBank. Both of us were working on the social platform, and we had the opportunity to discuss about what kind of, because I wanted to create my company at the time, so he asked me what kind of company, and I told him that, yeah, well, I was really interested in find a way to have like friend company to have their games more visible in Japanese market, and I, having my own experience living in France and seeing how difficult it was to find a publisher in the Japanese market. So that's something I wanted to somehow solve. And we had this discussion and we decided to, okay, then let's now, like, it was like 2011, like the smartphone was like still just available. The iPhone was still available only for the SoftBank. Not yet Docomo, another mobile operators. We had some Android phone, obviously, but my smartphone was still new, and people were like, okay, the different content was still in like HTML, was not what we call like native content, it was HTML content. So it's pretty like low quality, I would say. The game was working, like, but low quality content, no animations, things like that. And we decided, okay, let's make the company. In Europe or the US, they're already making native content with a lot of animation. The quality was kind of good and everything. So we said, okay, let's try to bring those content to the Japanese market and see how it goes. And why? Because it's obviously easier to just bring content than just developing yourself. So we thought, like, as a business model, it was pretty safe for us. So we started like this. We started to Just curate some great native content from Europe and US, and we caught up the attention of one of the second biggest mobile operator in Japan, which is KDDI. So you have three mobile operators: you have Docomo, the biggest one; you have KDDI, the second; and then the last one is SoftBank. And KDDI was interesting about what we are doing because at that time in Japan, like, operators started to think about, okay, we want to find a way to compete with those app stores, and we want to have our own stores. It's the usual like operators like business model, and they used to do that a lot with the era pre-smartphone, and they wanted to do the same with the Android. So they contacted us and said, "Okay, we are about to launch our own Android stores, and we're looking for content, and the content you guys have, it's like, it's good quality, it's not just HTML, so we're interesting, like, and you're doing publishing, so it means like potentially you can bring many contents amount, like two or three contents amounts, because you're not actually making, you're not developing those." And that's how it started. And then we say, okay, sure, so we already, like, we are publishing content for Apple and for the App Store and for Google Play, and then we added this store, which is like the KDDI store, the operator stores. So that's how we started, and the sales we've done on the KDDI store was pretty good, actually, because their model for the store was pretty unique at that time. It was not based on like micro purchase. The idea for them was like, okay, that's the model of the operator store. It's like, we're going to make a store where the users need to subscribe, like pay, like, let's say, like $5 a month. So users are going to pay like $5 a month. And by paying that, he's going to have access to a catalog of like maximum like 400 games freely. So he can play as much as he wants to any games. He's paying $5 a month. So that was the model. The idea is, like, once you do that, like, how do you pay a developer back to their game. So we have a game that we acquired from one company in the US, for example. We publish it, we release it on the operator store. So how we get the revenue? So the model was like, it's usage based. So it means like the more users going to play our game, the more we're going to receive a part of the overall revenue from what the user is actually paying. So as a result, we got a lot of revenue. User were playing a lot of our games, actually. And I guess one of the main reasons is because the content, our content was pretty like high quality compared to the existing content. Again, like I say, like most of the content in Japan at that time, 2011, 2012, were still like kind of HTML. And if I may just say like a quick, an additional explanation, is like as I explained like 10 minutes ago, like again, like it's important to know that before, like pre-iPhone, pre-smartphone, like user, like most of Japanese user, like own Japanese feature phone, and all the content were in HTML. So what does it mean? Like even with the arrival of smartphones, like that, Japanese game developer were still making HTML content for mobile because they've been doing that for a while, and it was kind of difficult for them to transit from HTML game to native game. And we had somehow like a good position on our side because we didn't have to learn new technology anyway. We just published the native content. So we were somehow like in advance of most of our competitors. And KDDI kind of like saw the result and said, okay, you guys, your model is great publishing. You're not making your own content, so it means like your time to market is pretty fast. So okay, that's how from that time, like it was like 2000. We built the company 2011. We started those talks with KDDI in early 2012. Like April, and we talk, and then at that time we started to. The content we were publishing at that time were still like it was still not yet free to play. It was a mix of premium, so pay to play, and a mix with like if you want to unlock like special skins, then you need to pay. We kind of have those games, and we met with a US company, which is called Godzilla, and they had like a simulation kind of game when you have to make your own village with small, cute animals. And this game used the free-to-play model. So the model was perfect for the Japanese market. So while we were in different talks with KDDI, so we had this content that we were in talks with the developer to acquire for Japanese market, and KDDI saw that and said, okay, you guys, obviously like you're capable of acquiring like content from abroad like pretty consistently. The content that you're acquiring are pretty good quality, as I explained just before. And now because like European and US start to catch up little by little, then the content you get, you're acquiring, already like start to be like really close to the Japanese model. So that's how they decided to, okay, we want to invest. And my partner, which is, like I said, Japanese, handle all those paper and all those talks, because now I do speak Japanese, but at the time it was not really the case. And that's how we received the investment. The talks, as I said, like started like early, like April 2012, and we received investment by the end of the year 2012.
And that's it for this first part of our conversation with Frederik. If you want to know more about entrepreneurship in Japan, about the common pitfalls when first entering the market, how to avoid them, as well as on how the Japanese are slowly changing their outlook on the merits of entrepreneurship, please be sure to join us for the second part of this episode, which we'll be publishing early next week. This is Nikolai signing out for the French Tech APEC podcast.